Welcome back to Gulf Coast Live. I'm Julie Glenn. A book that reads more like a Hollywood action movie is actually based on the true stories of Florida game wardens. You think it's just about checking people's fishing licenses? Think again. Former Florida game warden Bob Lee's first book told his own stories as a backcountry lawman as a Florida game warden. His new book saw him travel around the state from Live Oaks near the Georgia border to the Everglades, getting stories from fellow wardens and cataloging their most extreme experiences on the job in a book entitled Bad Guys, Bullets, and Boat Chases, True Stories of Florida Game Wardens. He's joining us now. Bob Lee, welcome to Gulf Coast Live.
Well, thank you so much for having me on.
Poachers, boat chases, and dangerous encounters with criminals and wildlife. We're talking about the true stories of Florida game wardens with author Bob Lee. What questions have you always wanted to ask a game warden? Give us a call and ask those questions or share your own stories at 877-428-8255. That's 877-GCU-TALK. On Facebook, we're at WGCU Public Media, and on Twitter, we are at WGCU using the hashtag GCL. So, Bob Lee, one question. You begin the book with the question you say you often get asked. Why do you carry a firearm if you are, as you write, only checking fishing licenses?
Well, that's kind of the underlying premise of the book. And so I set out to show that game wardens are indeed more than mere license checkers. And your point's well taken. If you took any city in Florida and just walked down the sidewalk and stopped a random individual and asked them, you know, what does a conservation law enforcement officer do in Florida? They probably scratch their heads and for a moment, and then they'd say, well, those are the guys that check fishing licenses. I think maybe they check boat cushions and something of that nature that's kind of generic. And through no fault of their own, this is pretty much what all they understand because our line of work in conservation law enforcement, we get really very, very little press when you compare it to, the Florida Highway Patrol or the sheriff's deputies or your big city police departments. And if I may, I'd like to add one more point as to the why of that. In the United States, there are roughly about 1 million city, state, and federal law enforcement officers. You compare that to about 6,000 officers that are certified conservation law enforcement officers to patrol millions of acres of state, federal, private lands, all the oceans, the streams, the rivers. There's just really a handful for that enormous task. And so
that's nationwide, that number?
Yeah. Yes, that's nationwide. And so the New York City Police Department at 28,000 would have 4.5 times more than all the conservation law enforcement officers in the United States.
Well, and, you know, I think a lot of that misperception may have to do with the fact that most people aren't breaking the law and almost pretty much come in contact when they're getting their fishing license checked or the number of cushions on their boats and life preservers, right? So that would be where most people see you.
That's absolutely correct. And that kind of also is what separates our line of work, and that probably, at least in my experience, 92-95% of the folks that you check, let's just say on a weekend, that are out fishing, totally legitimate. You compare that to, I'll just use for instance, with a sheriff's deputy. Whenever they stop somebody, a violation has been committed of some sort. It might only be a civil infraction, but some sort of a violation has been committed. Whereas with us, we do what we call administrative stops to establish that a boat's in compliance with the creel limit, the fish limit, or the life preservers on board and so forth.
So in that 5%, what is it that the wardens do that makes their job so exciting and then also dangerous?
Well, that 5%, I mean, a lot of them could be just, you know, license violations, but then an even smaller percentage, you get into the hardcore poachers then. And so that can become quite dangerous and exciting, which is what I try to show in at least a good many of the chapters in my newest effort here, just what it's like to be alone in the dark and to take somebody on who spent their whole life, this is what they do. You know, they're very cunning and wily, and it's just a real challenge to try to catch some of these folks.
Yeah, it's incredible. And when you say about in the dark, it is really dark. I mean, out there in the Everglades, there's just nothing. Well, it even got a dark sky park designation. So,
Well, exactly. And again, that kind of separates us from, you know, conventional law enforcement, in that they have a ready backup within 30 seconds to a minute, whereas with us, particularly in my own experiences starting out, there is no backup.
Well, you're out in the middle of nowhere. Yeah.
Exactly. And if you called for help, some folks wouldn't even know how to find you. Now, today it's a little bit different with our radio systems. We have GPS tracking the officers. But back when I began in 1977, I'll give you a for instance. I was an eight-month rookie, and my patrol boat suddenly sank at midnight in the Ocklawaha River, and I was left floating out on a six-gallon gas tank through a gauntlet of alligators. Now, for those of you who have never been, or your listeners who have never been on the Ocklawaha, it would make the perfect backdrop for a Tarzan movie. I'm alone. Dispatch doesn't know that my boat has sunk, and I am literally there. And you know, and so it's you're left to your own wits and to get out of that situation. That's
well, how'd
a lot
you get
of
out of that? Don't leave me hanging here. You're floating right now on a six-gallon gas can. I want to know what happened.
Right, and it is the dark of the moon, what we call the dark of the moon or a moonless night. And back in 1977, there were no legal gator hunts, which means these gators were so thick, and you shine a spotlight down a straightaway in this creek, and you would see 50, 70, 80 pairs of eyes, enormous alligators up to maybe close to 14 feet. And so as I was floating down on this gas can, being very young and perhaps a little naive, I thought things were just going to be all ducky until a big bull gator jumped off the bank just in front of me. Now, I couldn't see the alligator, but I heard him when he made this enormous splash. And then when his wake washed over me, I can still remember this little metal chain in the this gas can going tink, tink, tink as it's beating back and forth from having been rocked by his wake. So that, at that point in time, I began to reconsider my choice of trying to get out of there on that gas can.
But changed your outlook a little bit, yeah.
Yeah, it did. It was kind of a pucker moment, if you will. So, but eventually I floated into the only hard soil landing on this creek where there happened to be some fishermen camped. And I walked up there about 1 o'clock in the morning. Of course, I'm sopping wet, and they are just absolutely plastered. Don't even hardly recognize who I am. I have to tell them about three times who I am. And so finally I get kind of commandeer one of their sedans, and I drive while the owner is in the passenger seat because he was too drunk to drive me. And I drive into Salt Springs, which is a little town about 15 miles away, and then I got on a payphone, used my credit card, called my supervisor, and then about 6 hours later, finally got my boat out. But that turned out to be quite a little ordeal, but
a little ordeal.
That goes to show
you,
right? And so, but that's not a unique situation back in the 70s and the 80s for officers on patrol alone. Oh, there's all sorts of stories out there like that, and that's what I try to capture in my latest effort, which covers the entire state. Whereas in Backcountry Lawman, which was my first book, were mainly about my experiences and the guys I worked with in a narrow geographic area in Northeast Florida.
So you opened this new book with a unique perspective on Eastern Airlines Flight 401, which is a famous plane crash in the Everglades in December of 1972, that same era. You tell the story by following a game warden who basically saw the plane crash while he was just 25 miles away. Tell me a little bit about that.
Sure. So the star of this chapter, if you will, is Gray Leonard. I came to know Gray back in 82 when he transferred in and became my supervisor when I was a river patrol officer on the St. John's River. And so, but that's how I got to know him. But when he had just started out, he was a rookie on patrol alone with only like 2 months under his belt. And he's on the L-28 levee, which is about 40 miles across the Everglades and would be northwest of Miami International Airport, when all he sees is this, for 6 to 7, 8 seconds, is just kind of a plume of flame, just a brightness on the horizon toward Miami. And then it died down, and like he told me later, he said, you know, it kind of looked like somebody had thrown gasoline on a campfire. And he, at the time, believed it was like a commuter plane that had crashed. But what if he had been closer to it, he might have realized it was a wide-body jet. But he was 25 miles away. That's why it looked so small to him. And then eventually he is called in to assist, and he works survivor and body recovery for the next 3 days. And his perspective has never been told before. There's been two books and a couple of movies made about this plane crash, but nobody's ever told Gray's story. And at the toward the end of this chapter is a very interesting rescue that he's involved with. And And also, just briefly, to show what's going on in the plane, I also interviewed a stewardess and a passenger who survived the crash. But I kind of tell it from their point of view, what's going on in the plane, why the plane crashed. So we switch scenes back and forth.
Well, that's an interesting perspective on that story. And the warden spent 3 days. I imagine, some devastation that was just unspeakable.
Right. Well, there were 176 occupants on board. 13 were crew. 75 were killed. 75 survived. Then there were 101 fatalities.
Yeah, and that's not easy for anyone to be able to deal with. I mean, what would you want readers to take away from a story like that? I mean, what does it say about game wardens and the work that they do?
Well, mainly they'll do the job that needs to be done. But even from Graves' perspective, when he hired on, and he spent two tours with Uncle Sam in Southeast Asia. So he was very familiar with death. But like he told me in the interview I did when he said, Bob, I thought I was just going to be out there chasing poachers. That's what I was out there for that night, was to try to catch a deer poacher on an airboat. And suddenly you're thrust into this situation that it's almost beyond, it's like the apocalypse. I mean, you've got dead bodies everywhere, and people are screaming, children are crying, and there's pieces of the wreckage scattered over about a 1,600-foot swath, about 1,600-foot swath, about 300 feet wide. So it was just an eye-opening experience for him, and not something we would normally get into, obviously. I mean, that's probably a once-in-a-career-time experience, but those are some of the stories I'm trying to show, the real outliers of things that nobody would believe that we might become involved with.
Yeah. We are talking about the dangerous job of Florida game wardens with author Bob Lee. You can join the conversation, too, by giving us a call at 877-428-8255. That's 877-GCU-TALK. And you talk about the idea of chasing poachers. There's one story that you share in the book called Gill Netters in the Dark. It's a story of two rookie game wardens that are targeting outlaw commercial fishermen that are going after Pompano near Big Pine Island in Matlache Pass. Can you set that scene for us and tell me why these outlaw fishermen are even going after Pompano in the first place?
Sure. So I always like, as a writer, I like a story where you've got two rookies up against professional poachers, professional outlaws who were born and raised on Pine Island. This is all they've ever done. They know these mangroves and those sandy shoals and all the islands and literally like the back of their hand. And then you have these two rookies 5 months out of the Wildlife Academy and are thrust into this unbelievable event, which happens to turn out to be a hell-bent for leather boat chase through the mangrove jungles at about 4 in the morning. And so the reason why this happened in 2006, and so in 2006, it's a third-degree felony to flee from law enforcement on the water. It's a third-degree felony to operate a gill net within state waters. There are civil fines attached that can run up to $5,000. So the risk for these guys, these outlaws, is huge. But the reason why they're risking it all, literally, is because of this forked tail fish, the saltwater finfish called the pompano. And in the vernacular of Pine Island commercial fishermen, they're known as golden nuggets. They sell for about $3.50 to $4 a pound in the rough, meaning with the intestines still in them, to the wholesale fish houses. But when I was working on the story, I also interviewed, in addition to the officers, one of our investigators named Larry Jernstead. And Larry was the puppet master behind the scenes, the guy who was coaching these two rookies on how to do. And one of the stories he told me, it was kind of a sidebar, was he said one night I was out there, this happened about 2005, he's patrolling by himself, and he sees a gillnet boat pulled up in the mangroves. So he makes a beeline for it, shines his light on it, and there's two individuals in the boat, a big guy and a small guy. Big guy dives out of the boat and swims away. And then that leaves a smaller guy. Well, as Larry comes up to the vessel to tie off, turns out that it's a 16-year-old kid. The guy that dove overboard was his dad. And so this is fairly typical with how the poachers will do down there, because the juveniles are treated more leniently by the courts. And so Larry thinks that this is a teachable moment and tells the kid, you really shouldn't be out here doing this. But the kid responds, but sir, I made $15,000 last week as a crewman on a gillnet boat. And so Larry, who's never at a loss for words, that was a real stumper for him. And it's a good way to illustrate the value or the worth of this product, you know, because high-end chefs, it's high, you know, they love it for the buttery, creamy taste when the pompano is baked. And it commands a very high price at these seafood restaurants.
It's kind of hard to argue with someone, you know, when they point to what they're making. Even, you know, and it's just, but it's still not legal no matter what.
So it's not legal. Gillnets were banned as a constitutional amendment and went to a vote of the public in Florida, and it passed by 72%. So in 1994, it was banned, mainly because it was destroying a lot of the fish stocks. It's a net that doesn't choose between fish, if you will. I mean, any fish that goes in there of a certain size will be caught and basically strangled between the webbing.
And you had some pretty interesting characters that came up. There's a situation where the wardens are chasing down a larger-than-life guy known as William Bad Bill Jackson. Tell me about this guy and that nickname.
Well, he is a Pine Island fisherman. And of course, this name, I don't... In most of these stories, I use a pseudonym. I don't use the real name, except with the two chapters involved in attempted murder of a law enforcement officer. There, I use the guy's real names because they're doing life. But in this particular case, William Bad Bill Jackson was actually a mixed martial arts fighter in addition to being an outlaw commercial fisherman. He'd won three bouts in Fort Myers. The guy was making close to $100,000 a year, drove a brand-new Z71 pickup truck. He often referred to himself as Billy the Kid, some of these fictional Western characters. He had this grandiose ego. And when he was eventually caught that night by Officer Rich Wilcox, it took a lot to catch him because he dove out of the boat and swam away. But eventually when he's caught, he tells Rich, who's standing in his boat, and Bad Bill's in the water. He's in cut-off jeans. And he tells the officer, he says, you know, they're going to be, you know, after you're gone, they're going to be singing songs about me. They're not going to be singing songs about you. This is what he tells the officer, you know, after this brutal boat chase. And Rich is just shaking his head. He says, I didn't hire on to have a song sung about me. And then the guy goes on. He says, you know who Wyatt Earp is? And Rich says, yeah. He says, well, I always say one day I'll be caught by Wyatt Earp. And then Rich says, well, I guess that brings us full circle because you're under arrest, you know, climbing the boat. And so the guy just had an enormous ego, which makes it, you know, more a better story. So
yeah. We have a call coming in I wanted to get to. This is Alexandra. Okay. Alexandra, what would you like to say?
Oh, Bob. Let me turn my radio off. There we go. Bob, hi, this is Alexandra in Mount Dora.
Alexandra in Mount Dora, what would you like to say?
Oh, I just wanted to tell your audience what terrific books these are that he has written. They're factual and informative and a really good read. And I wanted the listeners to know about that.
All right, great. Well, that's some good advice. You have a fan on the phone who wanted to call and say hi and sing your praises. So, another story that you include in the book also took place here in Southwest Florida. It's the story of two audacious businessmen who took to using camouflaged planes for poaching in Highlands and Glades counties. Tell me about that.
In this particular story, I like it when the character has a background, a particular background that helps in the event he's involved with. In this particular case, we have an FWC. When I use the acronym FWC, I'm talking about the Florida Fish and Wildlife Conservation Commission. He's flying our helicopter, and he happens to have been a decorated Vietnam helicopter gunfighter pilot. And so he goes head-to-head, literally in an aerial duel, with a fixed-wing J-3 Piper Cub flown by two, I'm going to call them knucklehead deer poachers, that had been flying across three different counties, flying in, landing, trying to kill deer and turkey and so forth. And so the big showdown is when they go into this private cattle ranch to try to catch them, and the Piper Cub tries to ram them, literally in midair, this helicopter. Well, Lance Hamm is the pilot. That's his name. And when I interviewed him, I said, weren't you worried? I mean, there's a photograph in the book that shows this plane like 30 feet from the bubble of the helicopter's windshield on a direct course to hit it, right? I mean, there's no doubt what's going on. And he said, I said, no, I wasn't worried. He said, I had flown Piper Cubs before. He said, I was a spray pilot for 7 years for FWC. He said, I knew the aerodynamics of this Piper Cub very well, and I knew that the rotor wash from my helicopter could blow the lift out from underneath this Piper Cub. And at the last possible second, the plane just kind of falls from the sky like the Jolly Green Giant had put his hand on top of it and just shoved it right down to the ground. And eventually they get the guys hemmed in and get them caught up. But there's a big, long story to this, and it was like a three-month investigation. And it's pretty interesting because even after the guy's caught, eventually his plane is returned. There's various reasons why. But he doesn't stop poaching, Julie. He camouflages the plane because now he thinks, well, it's going to be harder for them to follow me because his original plane was yellow in color. Now he's got it camouflaged. And so the guys, our officers, you know, they continue to try to catch the pilot of this plane. His name is Ken Nesbitt. And that effort leads to several of them almost getting killed by accident. There's all sorts of things that happen. One guy almost gets his head cut off when the plane goes to take off, even though Ken didn't know he was hiding behind this wax myrtle bush. Two other guys get hit by a lightning bolt while they're on the stakeout, to the point to where they're knocked off this knoll and rolled down into a canal. And matter of fact, the holster was blown off the leather gun belt of one of the officers.
Wow.
It's crazy what they went through to try to try to catch him.
Just to get this guy. What was this guy trying to poach?
Deer, turkey. And like I interviewed, I think I interviewed five officers for this, supervisors. And one of them told me, the guy who was the head over uniform patrol for that county or that area, he told me, he says, listen, Bob, he says, these guys were really ineffective in their poaching. They really didn't kill much game, although all the ranchers were complaining because they kept landing on their properties, attempting to do so. But what he told me was the problem was there were two more individuals who owned planes who were talking about camouflaging their plane because they thought this was a good idea, and they were going to start copycatting him, Ken Nesbitt. So this particular lieutenant who I was talking to said, we had to end it, or else everybody would be out there flying all around Hendry and Glaze and Highlands counties trying to kill deer off these Texas, you know, Texas-sized ranches. So
how did that end up ending, that guy's case?
It ended when Ken Nesbitt flew his plane into an orange grove and killed himself along with his niece.
Oh.
We weren't following him. We weren't even involved with watching him on this particular day. It was just an outing, I guess, to take his niece up for just a scenery flight, if you will, a recreational flight. And he buried it into an orange grove and it caught on fire. And so that's the end of that story.
Yeah. So that was more accidental after
right.
all that chasing and all that. So as far as poaching, how do people try to avoid getting involved in supporting poaching? I mean, they're black market gator parts and things like that. What kind of things can consumers do to try to discourage that?
What can they do? That's a very good question.
I mean, because how do you know that what you've got that you're looking at a store has been gotten legally? Is there any
– Gotten illegally? You probably don't. That's kind of beyond the control of the wholesale fish houses. But it's really our job. Well, here's how the public can help. They can be our eyes and ears. And I've made, when I was working, oh my gosh, Julie, I made so many great cases off our Wildlife Alert program. If they go to myfwc.com, that's the agency's website. There's a link for the Wildlife Alert program that they can learn more about this, and they are paid in cash. If we catch the guy, and if it's an endangered or threatened species, there's more money involved, but we have to have a conviction. But just us making the arrest, they can be paid in cash. The minimum is probably like around $250, up to $500 and a lot more for an endangered or threatened species. And, of course, their names will be kept confidential. But I've made a lot of good cases. So that's how they can help out. I mean, let's take
report
Pine
things.
Island Matlachet Pass. They see somebody out there with a gill net, boom, just give us a holler.
Yeah.
And give us the position, and the guys will do the best they can to catch them up.
So when people come upon game wardens in Florida, what do you think that they should know? I mean, what kind of work are they likely doing, and what kind of pressures does that kind of job put on you every day that people may not know about, like interacting?
Well, it more than likely, you know, any of your listeners or the vast majority, when they come up on them, they will have probably be in the process of some legal activity. But the officer's just coming up for a routine check just to establish that you have your licenses or that you haven't exceeded the bag limit for your catch, or that you are in compliance with boating safety regulations. And the officer's just going to, you know, he's going to check you. And when everybody's got a stick. And when I used to go up to a boat, I wouldn't just pull up and rudely say, "Let me see your fishing license." I chat them up first, you know, and particularly if there's kids in the boat, I'd ask them how they were doing and, you know, did you catch any fish? And we'd talk for a minute or two, and then finally I'd work around to, you know, "I'd like to see your license, please," and so forth. And and I think that's how most of us like to do it. And so to take a soft approach. And so just, you know, do what they ask, and then they'll go on and on about their business. But it is a job where you are often alone. I can't emphasize that enough, and largely without ready backup.
Yeah, well, it's a lot of people spread over a lot of space. And then to bring it full circle, and we're going to wrap it up, but I just wanted to follow up on one of the first things that we talked about. So when you pulled yourself out of that river and you encountered that fish camp of guys that barely knew their own names, did you check their license?
No. Well, they weren't fishing. No, I wouldn't have checked yours anyway. When you need help, Julie.
You're like, I don't care if you got your license or not.
They were well past fishing stage. They were deep into their cups, let me tell you.
they were past fishing.
I mean, they were smashed.
Well, at least they were there and you got yourself saved.
Well, so, yeah, it would have been a long hike.
Yeah.
It would have been a long hike. Yeah.
Well, we're going to have to leave things there. I want to thank our guest, Bob Lee. We have links to your books and to other works on our website at WGCUnews.org. Just click on the tab that says Gulf Coast Live, and it'll direct you there. Thanks for joining us today.
Thank you.
Gulf Coast Live is made possible through the generous support of the Elizabeth B. McGraw Foundation. This is WGCU-FM, Fort Myers 90.1, WMKO Marco Island 91.7 FM, NPR for Southwest Florida.